I'm very pleased to welcome you back, Martin Drum, to View from the Roundhouse. How are you going?
It's fabulous to be here, Michael.
Well, we wondered last week what we could possibly talk about this week. Martin, fortunately, the former Prime Minister, who always had the knack of getting himself into the headlines, hasn't lost that knack since he was voted out of office. He's now the humble MP for Cook. If you reverse the MP, of course, he's the former PM, and made a lot of news as co-minister, apparently, for at least five ministries leading up to the last election. But perhaps before we come to that very topical topic, so much happening. Ukraine is still bubbling along. We don't hear so much about it in local media. Taiwan seems to have gone off the front page. The state government in Western Australia is bubbling along, announcing things, being innovative, spending money on education, all very good. But internationally, the US doesn't quite go away. Mr. Trump is still banging on about the FBI invading his Mar-a-Lago premises and taking things. And of course, he endorses candidates, it seems. He's a one-man endorsement machine. And one of the results seems to be that Liz Cheney lost the primaries in Wyoming, where she's been for some years, the daughter of a former vice president. What's going on in the US? Should we forget about the US, Martin? That'd be anathema to an internationalist like you.
In a way, we can't forget about the US. There was a famous line in Seinfeld, it's awful, but I can't look away. And I think that sometimes describes politics in the US. It's very messy. It's very polarised. It's very personal. Liz Cheney was the third highest ranking Republican MP in Congress. And so it's been a very fast fall for her because she dared to take on the juggernaut that is Donald Trump. So she's certainly lost and lost badly in the primary in Wyoming. The Republican primary that for her seat, it's the sole seat from Wyoming in the House of Representatives in Congress. But I don't think this is done. That she does have a potential weapon up her sleeve, and that's whether she might consider running as an independent candidate for president. In their system, they have first past the post. So if the worst case scenario for Donald Trump, if he does run again, is that someone who's conservative, who has a high profile, who dislikes him intensely, runs against him and peels off votes in a whole range of states. So Liz Cheney may not have much support in Wyoming, which is cowboy country, and they probably like the boldness and brashness of Donald Trump. But if she was to run for president as a third party candidate, gee, that would make things really, really interesting.
Well, when the not quite as conservative liberal women all ran in our last election, they were called and still are called the Teal Independents, but teal being a slightly softer shade of blue. I wonder what Liz Cheney would be. She would be a pink independent, I suppose, a slightly lighter shade of the Republican red.
Yes, pink would fit the bill there, although it's in the eyes of some Republicans, being called pinko is not a great thing.
That's a very good point. All right, we'll return to the important colour question for Liz Cheney in future episodes. But domestically, lots of things happening. I'm very pleased to see that electric vehicles is being put up front and centre for some immediate discussion. Chris Bowen, the climate change minister, is on it. The breaking news is all of those teal independents have got their Commonwealth cars, perhaps their electric, personally owned vehicles, taking them to the big meeting. It'd be a good thing to see, an active thing to see, Martin, if they can bring down the cost of electric vehicles in Australia for the ordinary consumer who can't think of shelling out $60,000 plus.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important and emerging area. It's been emerging for some time when we talk about electric vehicles, but the technology is getting better, the performance is getting better, and slowly we hope the price is coming down. All of those factors are going to make a difference, certainly if we've got emerging regular batteries inside people's own houses, which will help with the convenience of charging, but which all, importantly, will harness solar better. Because, of course, if you're only accessing electricity off the grid, you're still using electricity. So all of those ancillary parts, and of course, having regular charging stations, which the state government here is committed to, at least along the major highways, all of those things will make a big difference. So that infrastructure around electric vehicles will be important too. But, you know, if you're thinking about the bigger macro environment picture, everyone says that the first one's about energy production and generation, and the second one is cars. So if we're able to address both of those, then we will make fairly big strides in this area.
Seems to be a lot of goodwill. The other area where there also seems to be a lot of goodwill is in relation to the forthcoming Jobs and Skills Summit. Plainly, Australian industry in its various forms, backpackers in cafes, skilled workers on mine sites and in factories, everybody seems to be getting behind it. On the face of it, does require a revision of our immigration numbers. What are you making of all of that? Are we heading into some new world?
Look, it's interesting, and you know, I never want to kibosh good ideas and bringing people together, because I think that's great. But these are fairly complex things, so it'll be interesting to see how well the One Summit can actually break through the barriers. The skill shortage is linked to things like a lack of skilled migration, also stymied skills development, and there's pipeline issues there. So if you want to suddenly upskill a whole cohort of people like nurses, there's a 4 to 5 year pipeline minimum. So you can't just solve these problems overnight. There's quite a bit involved. So I'll be interested to see what ideas come out, but I don't think we're going to see a magic bullet at this stage.
Martin, your field is the tertiary, the university sector. Do they have an important interest in this topic? Foreign students are important.
Absolutely. So we're in the business of learning, but we're also in the business of skills development. And you know, I talked about nursing, but nursing and education are just two areas where the state government and industry relies very heavily on skilled professionals. But it's across the board. The highly skilled professionals rely on tertiary degrees. So the federal government's released more Commonwealth-supported places to try and give this a bit of a nudge along. That's just come out this week, actually. But again, it will be a 3 to 4 year pipeline. You don't usually upskill people at university level in the space of one semester. So that's just one example of why I think this is going to take a while to resolve. You can fix some problems by migration, but our Commonwealth government has massive delays in providing visas at the moment. So that no doubt is playing a role here too. So there's a lot of things that are linked up with this.
Complicated thing, life. You suddenly have wars, you have refugees, you have, in a sense, forced changes to migration intakes. Getting visas out is, as you say, another thing. All of which brings me to the topic of Ukraine. The war's been, don't hesitate to use the expression, bubbling along, but hastening and that's at times and slowing down at other times. There's a problem, a threat to another nuclear power plant in Ukraine, and the UN Secretary General is making warning noises about that at the moment. But in many ways, as indeed with Taiwan, we hear a lot about it. It's on the front page of the newspaper, so to speak, coming up on our smartphones and tablets and PCs every morning we open up once upon a time, but less so now. What goes on when you look at these things as an internationalist? Is it just the media cycle and we forget about it? Does the war still go on?
Yeah, this is a really interesting point that you made. The problem with war is it doesn't get better, it gets worse. And the longer you have wars, the more bloody-minded the combatants get. The more entrenched they are in their positions. For the people of Ukraine, they elicited a lot of sympathy when the war started because we were shocked and horrified that a war was happening in Europe in 2022. But the longer it goes on, more other complications in life overshadow that war. The war hasn't stopped, and for the people who are suffering in that area, it seems to be getting worse, but we're looking away. We get normalised and desensitised to these things. So I think the situation in Ukraine is quite bleak. There doesn't appear to be any end in sight. What you're going to get is fairly entrenched positions on both sides, and the rest of the world will maybe engage every now and then when a particular atrocity comes across our screens, but sadly it's become an international norm to see cities bombed like that. We just look at it and go, well, yeah, that's been happening for months. So I really do feel for the plight of the Ukrainian people.
You get the impression at times, as I did the other day when there was an explosion in the Crimea, and it's not altogether clear to me whether it was a Ukrainian sponsored attack on a site, but it made me think that this is a war that could finish up like the one in Afghanistan. Perhaps we'll have a, in that sense, a guerrilla war that lasts for some years.
The other problem you get in war, it's, you know, it's in media and journalism circles, we call it the fog of war. It's very difficult to verify facts during war. It's very difficult to know who's responsible at times, which is why you get atrocities and they're rarely punished. And fake news and misinformation just flourish. And we've already got lots of channels for misinformation and fake news. And in war, the incentive to engage in fake news just escalates. And you're actually going to get attacks and atrocities and both sides pointing to each other and blaming each other.
Well, we go from all of that to the theatre of domestic national politics, Martin, with the discovery, in a sense, the announcement this week, the leak, if you like, by a couple of journalists writing a book who seem to have interviewed the former PM, Scott Morrison, about the time he was in the thick of things still as PM, that he'd appointed himself more or less as a co-minister in five other ministries apart from what he was doing, and in a sense the most important of them being the ministry held by the deputy Liberal leader Josh Frydenberg at the time of Treasurer. But health, resources, social security, and finance, I think, Matthias Cormann, a right-hand man in just about every respect to the PM at the time. And no one except Hunt, apparently, the health minister, knew about this. Now, there's been an enormous amount of ink spilt and fingernails worn out on keyboards over the course of this week. We're going to hear on Monday from the Commonwealth Solicitor General, the top legal codger in Canberra, in a report that he'll give, an opinion he'll give to the PM Albanese about the legality and the appropriateness of all of this. One suspects there'll be changes, however you look at it, to the way these sorts of appointments are done, if they're legal. But what's been your take from the beginning? And have you gone up and down the sine curve during the course of the week to arrive at a different position?
Of all of the stories, you get a lot of crazy stories in politics, but this has got to be one of the most extraordinary and bizarre stories. But a story that really does, this is not Scott Morrison flitting off to Hawaii and people being outraged because he wasn't holding a hose, right? And as probably, even though that was poor judgment, didn't really impact our democratic system. Here, you've got him taking over without telling people very significant portfolios of state, or having himself sworn in to very significant portfolios of state. We might have dodged a bullet here, because if he started making more decisions in some of these portfolios, we'd have an enormous legal quagmire. You could have a situation, ministers get, I know you wrote about this, Michael, ministers get delegated decision-making abilities under legislation. So if you have two ministers who are both responsible for the same portfolio and have come to different determinations, what happens? Now, that didn't appear to have happened. He appears to have made a decision in the resources portfolio where he's basically weighed in, and the existing minister who did know about it, one of the few that did know about it, Keith Pitt, shut up and said nothing because his boss was overruling him, in fact. But, you know, this could have got really, really messy, especially as he didn't tell ministers that he was doing this. And you mentioned his deputy, the deputy Liberal leader and treasurer, who was actually living with him in the lodge for long periods of time. So you've got housemates that he doesn't share the news with. I mean, it's just astonishing that his own colleagues didn't know about this. If I'm not sure it would have been the best way to handle this, but if he had done this and told people at the time, maybe some of us would accept that because of the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic. So if at the start of the pandemic, he'd said, Greg Hunt has COVID, I'm taking over the health portfolio, the buck stops with me, all the decisions that affect your day-to-day life, I'm involved. And you go, okay, well, you're the Prime Minister. You know,
the questions you raise, the scenarios you just painted, just show how problematic it is. Because in the case of Greg Hunt, it appears that, yes, Hunt came down and he said, well, look, I can take over. And if a minister had been suddenly hospitalised or the like in those circumstances, then, yes, the PM presumably could have gone public and said, look, I'm letting everybody know that I've been appointed on the QT by the GG and I'm moving straight into looking after Mr. Hunt's portfolio while he lies in hospital. And people said, oh, that's good, just as well he was prepared. Perhaps they would have said that. I suspect it would have raised a whole lot of other questions. He would have been asked about the secret commission. He would have been asked when it was taken out. He would have been asked whether Hunt was sick at the time. Did he tell Hunt at the time he took it out? And are there any more? And if down the track, this is the other problem, isn't it? As has happened in the case of Keith Pitt's non-decision making, where Pitt would have granted an exploration for offshore resources work, the PM wanted plainly enough to make an environmentally uplifting decision for electoral reasons. Now it's being said, of course, that he came in and exercised the power with bias because he had a particular outcome in mind. Keith Pitt would have considered all of the papers, made a balanced decision. The argument is the PM did anything but. So you create all of these actual legal problems, quite apart from destroying trust with the electorate. I mean, is that a wrong-headed view of things, do you think?
No, I think that we're entitled to ask all those questions. And there is one extra thing that you touched on. The whole point of our political system is that ministers need to be accountable. So they need to be accountable to their colleagues. They need to be accountable in Parliament. So the whole purpose of Parliament convening is to question time that we see on our screens every day is ministers being held to account by opposition non-government MPs. That's our system.
Now, can you ask the question of?
But how can you ask questions of a minister when you don't know he's a minister for that area? You know, that's why people are upset about, you know, him trashing Westminster conventions. Westminster conventions don't, you know, we don't think about them in day-to-day life. We go about and buy a loaf of bread or a litre of milk. It's not really on our radar. But at the end of the day, it's at the heart of our system. If you don't know who's responsible, and how can you make them accountable? It was crazy. And we haven't had a proper, we've had completely conflicting explanations from Scott Morrison on this. On the one hand, he said he didn't think it was important enough to tell them, or there was an error of communication. On the other hand, he told them he deliberately didn't tell them because, it upset them. Well, of course it would upset them. I only wonder whether at the end of the day, maybe he didn't trust some of his colleagues. That's about the only explanation that kind of makes sense here. That would be extraordinary.
I must say, I actually think there's a strong argument that you can't have a number of reserve ministers appointed. In the article to which you refer on the Shipping News under my byline Friday on my mind, Canberra or Pyongyang. I suggest Canberra's system of government is at least meant to be different from that in a totalitarian country like North Korea. The point is, we've got this strong constitutional underpinning inherited from the British system that we have representative and responsible government. It carries very strong components. And it includes, as you've said, the accountability through the parliament to the public who have elected these people. Now, if you don't know who to ask questions of in parliament, it rather defies that principle. You can't call the right person to account. You have secret decision-making. It seems to me also that the argument of Morrison being able to appoint himself to a co-ministership in five other ministries, taken to its logical extension, means he could appoint himself to every ministry and, in fact, take over the whole of government. We suddenly migrate to the presidential system and he becomes somebody like Mr. Trump. And it has to be wrong. It'll be interesting to see just what the Solicitor General advises, but I expect the concept of representative and responsible government and ministerial decision-making and responsibility will figure large in what he has to say.
I really do hope that people take a bit of a stand over this, and including Liberal MPs, because they were the ones that actually disadvantaged some of his own colleagues, like Karen Andrews, who was Home Affairs Minister, no less, found out for the first time after the government fell that he'd done this, was deeply upset about it. It's not so much whether he resigns or not, because, you know, he's been Prime Minister and all that. It's more around whether, you know, he's censured in House of Representatives. It's whether he might face the Privileges Committee. I mean, the difficulty is how much does it tie to his role in Parliament? I would say it does, because he's misled Parliament by not telling them which ministerial portfolios that he has. So I think there is a case for privileges to investigate. These are all opaque processes for the layman, Michael, but they're actually statements by Parliament that this is not acceptable.
Well, Martin, we're going to have to draw this to an end.
Sadly.
I would have loved to have had Sammy Jay on to discuss this with us this morning.
That's been the best thing, has been the satire has been awesome.
The satire has been awesome. And people, if they haven't, should catch up with ScoMo's Side Hustles Exposed, Sammy Jay, last night on ABC iView. But I'm sure there's going to be some very firm solutions proposed once it's all over. But Martin, thanks for joining with me today. Who knows what will happen over the next 7 days, but we'll be here next week to discuss them. Thanks for joining me.
Look forward to it, as always.